Who on this earth can conceive the glory which God has prepared for his virgin spouses in paradise? Theologians say that virgins have in heaven their own aureola, or special crown of glory, which is refused to the other saints who are not virgins. But let us come at once to the most important point in our discourse. This young woman will say, "Cannot I become holy in the married state?" I do not wish to give you the reply in my own words. Hear those of St. Paul, and you will see the difference between the married woman and the virgin. And the married woman and the virgin, thinking on the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and in spirit. But she that is married thinketh on the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And the apostle adds, "And I speak this for your profit, not for a snare, but for that which is decent, and which may give you power to attend upon the Lord without impediment." In the first place, I say that married persons can be holy in the spirit, but not in the flesh. On the contrary, virgins who have consecrated their virginity to Jesus Christ are both holy in soul and body. Holy both in body and in spirit. And mark those other words, "to attend upon the Lord without impediment." Oh, how many obstacles have not married women to encounter in serving the Lord? And the more noble they are, the greater the obstacles. A woman to become holy must adopt the necessary means, which are much mental prayer, constant use of the sacraments, and continual thought of God. But what time has a married woman for thinking upon God? "She that is married thinketh on the things of the world," says St. Paul. The married woman has to think of providing her family with food and raiment. She has to think of rearing her children, of pleasing her husband and her husband's relatives. Whence, as the apostle says, her heart is divided between God, her husband, and her children. Her husband must be attended to. The children cry and scream, and are continually asking for a thousand things. What time can she have to attend to mental prayer, who can scarce attend to all the business of the house? How can she pray amid so many distracting thoughts and disturbances? Scarcely can she go to church to recollect herself and communicate upon the Sunday. She may have the good desire, but it will be difficult for her to attend to the things of God as she ought. It is true that in this want of opportunity she may gain merit by resignation to the will of God, who requires of her in that state chiefly patience and resignation. But in the midst of so many distractions and annoyances, without prayer, without meditation, without frequenting the sacraments, it will be morally impossible for her to have that holy patience and resignation. But would to God that married woman had no other evil to contend with besides that of not always being able to attend to their sanctification as much as they should. The greater evil is the danger to which they are continually exposed of losing the grace of God by reason of the intercourse which they must continually have with the relatives and friends of their husband, as well as their own houses, as in the house of others. Unmarried women do not understand this, but married women, and those who have to hear their confessions, know it well. Let us, however, now have done with the unhappy life which is led by married women, the ill treatment that they receive from their husbands, the disobedience of children, the wants of a family, the annoyance of mothers-in-law and relatives, the throes of childbirth, always accompanied by danger of death, not to mention the afflictions of jealousy and scruples of conscience with regard to the rearing up of their children. All of this breeds a tempest under which poor married women have continually to groan. And God grant that in this tempest they may not lose themselves, so as to meet with hell in the other world after having suffered a hell in this. Such is the unenviable lot of those maidens who choose the world. But what, such a maiden replies, are there no married women holy? Yes, I answer, there are. But who are they? Such only as become holy through their sufferings, by suffering all from God without finding fault, and with continual patience. And how many married women are to be found in such a state of perfection? They are very rare, and if you find any, they are always in sorrow, that when they could have done so, they did not consecrate themselves to Jesus Christ. Amongst all the devout married women I have known, I never knew one to be satisfied with her condition. The greatest happiness, then, falls to the lot of those maidens who consecrate themselves to Jesus Christ. Those have to encounter none of the dangers which married women must necessarily be placed in. They are not bound to earth by love of children, or men, or dress, or gallantry, whilst married women are obliged to dress with pomp and ornaments in order to appear with their equals and please their husbands. A maiden who has given herself to Jesus Christ requires only what dress will cover her. Nay, she should give scandal if she were to wear any other, or make use of any ornaments. Moreover, virgins have no anxiety about house or children or relatives. Their whole care is centered in pleasing Jesus Christ, to whom they have consecrated their soul, their body, and all their love, whence it is that they have more time and a mind more disengaged for frequent prayer and communion. But let us now come to the excuses sometimes brought forward by those who are cold in the love of Jesus Christ. Such a one will say, "I should leave the world if I had some convent to go to, or at least if I could always spend my time in devotion at the church when I should please. But I could not remain at home, where I have bad brothers who ill-treat me, and on the other hand, my parents are unwilling to have me frequent the church. But I ask you, is it in order to save yourself or lead an easy life you leave the world? Is it to do your own will or the will of Jesus Christ? If you wish to become holy and serve Jesus Christ, I ask you another question. In what does holiness consist? Holiness does not consist in living in a convent or spending the entire day in a church, but in being at confession and communion as often as you can, in obedience, in doing everything assigned to you at home, in being retired, in bearing labor and contempt. And if you were to be in a convent, how should you be employed? Do you imagine you should always be either in church or in your cell, or in the refectory or at recreation? In the convent, although the sisters have a time marked out for prayer, for mass, and for communion, they have also their hours appointed for the business of the house. And more especially in the lay sisters, who, as they do not attend in the choir, have nearly all the labor of the house, and consequently least time for prayer. All exclaim, "Let us be in a convent, let us have a convent." How much more easy is it for devout girls to become holy in their own houses than in a convent? How many such have I known to regret having entered a convent, especially when the community was large, the poor lay sister in certain offices having scarcely time to say the rosary. "But, Father," such a girl will answer, "I have at home a peevish father and mother. I have bad brothers. All of them use me ill. I cannot stand this." Well, I say, and if you marry, will you not have to deal with mothers and sisters-in-law and perhaps undutiful children, and perhaps a harsh husband? Oh, how many cruel husbands are there not, who when first married promised great things, but shortly afterward ceased to be husbands and became the tyrants of their wives, treating them not as companions, but as slaves? Inquire of many married women whether this be not the fact. But without going beyond your own home, you all know how your mothers fared. One thing at least is certain, that all you should have to suffer at home, after having given yourself to God, you should suffer for the love of Jesus Christ, and He knows how to make your cross sweet and light to you. But how dreadful is it not to suffer for the world's sake, to suffer without merit? Courage, then, if Jesus Christ has called you to His love and wishes to have you for His spouse. Go on joyfully. It will be His care to afford you consolation even in the midst of sufferings. This, of course, will be only in case you truly love Him and live as His spouse. Hear then for the last time the means that you are to adopt in order to become holy and live a true spouse of Jesus Christ. And these are to practice the virtues becoming his spouse. We read in the gospel that the kingdom of heaven is likened unto virgins. But to what virgins? Not to the foolish, but to the wise. The wise were admitted to the nuptials, but the door was shut in the face of the foolish, to whom the spouse said, I know you not. You are indeed virgins, but I do not acknowledge you for my spouses. The true spouses of Jesus Christ follow the spouse whithersoever he goeth. These follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. What is the meaning of following the Lamb? St. Augustine says that it means the imitation of the Lamb both in body and mind. After you have consecrated your body to him, you must consecrate to him your whole heart, so that your heart may be entirely devoted to his love, and therefore you must adopt all the means that are necessary for making you belong entirely to Jesus Christ. The first of those means is mental prayer, to which you must be most attentive. But do not imagine that in order to pray thus, it is necessary for you to be in a convent or remain all day in the church. It is true that at home there is much disturbance created by the persons there. Nevertheless, those who wish can find time and place for prayer. This is in the morning before the others rise, and at night after the others have gone to bed. In order to pray, it is not necessary to be always on bended knees. You can pray whilst laboring, and even when walking out on business, should you have no other opportunity, by raising your soul to God and thinking on the Passion of Jesus Christ or any other pious subject. The second means is the frequentation of the sacraments of confession and communion. With regard to confession, each one has to make a choice of a confessor whom she is to obey in everything. Otherwise, she will never walk steadily in the way of perfection. As to communion, she must not depend solely upon obedience. She must desire it and ask for it. This divine food must be hungered after. Jesus Christ must be desired. It is frequent communion that renders his spouses faithful to Jesus Christ, especially in the preservation of holy purity. The Most Holy Sacrament preserves the soul in every virtue, and it appears that its most special effect is to preserve untouched the chastity of virgins, according to that of the prophet, who calls this sacrament the corn of the elect and wine springing forth virgins. The third means is retirement and caution. As the lily amongst the thorns, so is my beloved amongst the daughters. For a virgin to think of remaining faithful to Jesus Christ amid the conversations, the jests, and other amusements of the world is useless. It is necessary that she preserve herself amidst the thorns of abstinence and mortification by using not only the greatest modesty and reserve in speaking with men, but even all austerity and penitential exercises when necessary. Such are the thorns which preserve the lilies. I mean young maidens who otherwise should soon be lost. The Lord calls the cheeks of his spouse as beautiful as those of the turtle. Thy cheeks are beautiful as the turtle doves. And why so? Because the turtle, by instinct, avoids the company of other birds and always remains alone. That virgin then appears beautiful in the eyes of Jesus Christ, who does all that she can to hide herself from the eyes of others. Saint Jerome says that Jesus is a jealous spouse. Hence he is much displeased when he sees a virgin dedicated to him, endeavoring to appear before men to please them. Pious maidens endeavor to appear repulsive, that they may not attract men. The venerable sister Catherine of Jesus, afterwards a Theresian nun, washed her face with the filthy water of tar, and then designedly exposed her face to the sun, that she might lose her complexion. Saint Adrigina Jacinia, having, as we're told by Bolandus, been promised in marriage, prayed the Lord to deform her, and was heard, for she was immediately covered with a leprosy which caused everyone to avoid her. And as soon as her suitor had ceased his offers, her former beauty was restored. It is related by James de Viatrico that there was a certain virgin in a convent whose eyes had inflamed a prince. The latter threatened to set fire to the monastery if she would not yield to him, but she plucked out her eyes and sent them to him in a basin, the bearer of which was instructed to say, "Here are the darts which have wounded your heart. Take them, and leave my soul untouched." The same author tells of Saint Euphemia that, having been promised by her father to a certain count, who left no means untried to obtain her, she, in order to free herself from his addresses, cut off her nose and lips, saying to herself, "Vain beauty, you shall never be to me an occasion of sin." Saint Antoninus tells something similar, and his account is confirmed by Baronius of the Apus Iba, who feared an invasion of the barbarians, cut off her nose and upper lip to the teeth, and that all the other nuns, to the number of 30, followed her example, did the same. The barbarians came, and seeing them so deformed, set fire to the monastery through rage and burned them alive. And hence the church, as Baronius tells us, has enrolled them among her martyrs. This is not allowable for others to do. Those saints did so by the especial impulse of the Holy Ghost. But it sufficiently well answers the purpose of showing you what virgins who love Jesus Christ have done to prevent men from seeking them. Devout virgins at present should at least move as modestly and be seen as little as possible by men. Should it happen that a virgin should by chance, and without any fault of hers, receive by violence any insult from men, be it known to you that after it she will remain as pure as before. Saint Lucia made an answer of this kind to the tyrant who threatened to dishonor her. "If you do," she said, "and I be so treated against my will, my crown shall be double." It is the consent only that is hurtful, and know, moreover, that if a virgin be modest and reserved, men will have no inclination to interfere with her. The fourth means of preserving purity is the mortification of the senses. Saint Basil says a virgin should not be immodest in any respect, in tongue, ears, eyes, touch, and still less in mind. A virgin, in order to keep herself pure, must be modest in her speech, conversing seldom with men, and that only through necessity, and in few words. Her ears must be pure by not listening to worldly conversations. Her eyes must be pure by being either closed or fixed upon the earth in the presence of men. She must be pure in touch, using therein all possible caution, both as regards herself and others. She must be pure in spirit, by resisting all immodest thoughts, through the help of Jesus and Mary. And to this end she must mortify herself with fasting, abstinence, and other penitential exercises, which things she must not practice without the consent of her confessor, otherwise they should injure her soul by making her proud. Those acts of penance must not be made without the confessor's permission, but they must be desired and sought for the confessor, if he does not see the penitent wishing for them, will not give them. Jesus is a spouse of blood, who espoused our souls upon the cross, whereon he shed all his blood for us. A bloody spouse art thou to me. Therefore, those spouses who love him, love tribulation, infirmity, sorrows, ill-treatment, and injuries, and receive them not only with patience, but with joy. Thus may we understand that passage which says that virgins follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. They follow their spouse, Jesus, with joy and gladness, whithersoever he goeth, even through sorrow and disgrace, as has been done by so many holy virgins, who have followed him to torments and to death, smiling and rejoicing. Finally, sisters, in order that you may obtain perseverance in this holy life, you must recommend yourselves often and much to Most Holy Mary, the Queen of Virgins. She is the mediatrix who negotiates those espousals and brings virgins to espouse her son. After her, all virgins be brought to the king. It is she, in fine, who obtains fidelity for those chosen spouses, for without her assistance, they should be all unfaithful. In conclusion, then, come on, then, you who intend to live no longer for the world but for Jesus Christ alone. I address myself to those who feel themselves called by that divine spouse to concentrate themselves to his love. I do not wish that you should make any vow this morning or oblige yourselves at once to perpetual chastity. You should do that when God inspires you and your confessor is willing. I only desire you by a simple act and without any obligation to thank Jesus Christ for having called you to his love and to offer yourselves to him henceforward for your entire lives. Say then to him, O my Jesus, my God, and my Redeemer, who hast died for me, compassionate me, who burn to call myself thy spouse. I burn because I see that thou hast called me through that honor, nor do I know how to thank thee for that grace. I should now have been in hell, and thou, instead of chastising me, hast called me to be thy spouse. Yes, my spouse, I leave the world, I leave all through love of thee and give myself entirely to thee. What world do I speak of? My Jesus, henceforward, thou art to be my only good, my only love. I see that thou wishest to have my entire heart, and I wish to resign it entirely to thee. Receive me in thy mercy, and do not reject me as I have deserved that thou shouldst. Forget all the offenses that I have given thee, of which I repent with my whole soul. Would that I had died before offending thee. Pardon me, inflame me with thy holy love, and give me thy aid in order that I may be faithful to thee and never leave thee more. Thou, my spouse, hast given thyself all to me. Behold, I give myself entirely to thee. Mary, my queen and my mother, chain my heart to that of Jesus Christ and fasten both hearts so that they never sundered more. I leave you now my blessing in order that you may be so bound to Jesus Christ as never again to depart from him. Give your hearts now to Jesus Christ. Say, Jesus, my spouse, henceforward I wish to love only thee and nothing else. The vocation to the priesthood, necessity of a divine vocation to take holy orders. To enter any state of life, a divine vocation is necessary, for without such a vocation, it is, if not impossible, at least most difficult to fulfill the obligations of our state and obtain salvation. But if for all states a vocation is necessary, it is necessary in a particular manner for the ecclesiastical state. He that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up another way, the same is a thief and a robber. Hence, he who takes holy orders without a call from God is convicted of theft, in taking by force a dignity which God does not wish to bestow upon him. And before him, St. Paul said the same thing. Neither doth any man take the honor to himself, but he that is called by God, as Aaron was. So Christ also did not glorify himself, that he might be made a high priest, but he that said unto him, Thou art my son, this day I have begotten thee. No one then, however learned, prudent, and holy he may be, can thrust himself into the sanctuary unless he is first called and introduced by God. Jesus Christ himself, who among all men was certainly the most learned and the most holy, full of grace and truth, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Jesus Christ, I say, required a divine call in order to assume the dignity of the priesthood. In entering the sanctuary, even after God himself had called them to it, the saints trembled. When his bishop ordered St. Augustine to receive ordination, the saint, through humility, regarded the command as a chastisement of his sins. To escape the priesthood, Saint Ephrem of Syria feigned madness, and Saint Ambrose pretended to be a man of cruel disposition. To avoid the priesthood, Saint Ammonius the monk cut off his ears and threatened to pluck out his tongue if the persons who pressed him to take holy orders should continue to molest him. In a word, Saint Cyril of Alexandria says, "The saints have dreaded the dignity of the priesthood as a burden of enormous weight." Can anyone then, says Saint Cyprian, be so daring as to attempt of himself and without a divine call to assume the priesthood? As a vassal, who would of himself take the office of minister, should violate the authority of his sovereign, so he who intrudes himself into the sanctuary without a vocation violates the authority of God. How great should be the temerity of the subject who, without the appointment, and even in opposition to the will of the monarch, should attempt to administer the royal patrimony, to decide lawsuits, to command the army, and to assume the viceregal authority. Among you, asks Saint Bernard in speaking to clerics, is there anyone so insolent as, without orders and contrary to the will of the pettiest monarch, to assume the direction of his affairs? And are not priests, as Saint Prosper says, the administrators of the royal house? Are they not, according to Saint Ambrose, the leaders and rectors of the flock of Christ? According to Saint Chrysostom, the interpreters of the divine judgments? And according to Saint Denis, the vicars of Christ? Will anyone who knows all this dare to become the minister of God without a divine call? To think of exercising royal authority is, according to Saint Peter Chrysogulus, criminal in a subject. To intrude into the house of a private individual in order to dispose of his goods and to manage his business would be considered temerity, for even a private individual has the right of appointing the administrators of his affairs. And will you, says Saint Bernard, without being called or introduced by God, intrude into his house to take charge of his interest and to dispose of his goods? The Council of Trent has declared that the Church regards not as her minister, but as a robber, the man who audaciously assumes the priesthood without a vocation. Such priests may labor and toil, but their labor shall profit them little before God. On the contrary, the works which are meritorious in others shall deserve chastisement for them. Should a servant who is commanded by his master to take care of the house, through his own caprice, labor in cultivating the vineyard, he may toil and sweat, but instead of being rewarded, he shall be chastised by his master. Thus, in the first place, because they are not conformable to the divine will, the Lord shall not accept the toils of the man who, without a vocation, intrudes himself into the priesthood. I have no pleasure in you, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will not receive a gift of your hand. In the end, God will not reward, but will punish the works of the priest who has entered the sanctuary without a vocation. What stranger soever cometh to it, the tabernacle, shall be slain. Whosoever then aspires to holy orders must, in the first place, carefully examine if his vocation is from God. For, says Saint John Chrysostom, the more sublime the dignity, the more should one assure oneself of a divine vocation. Now, to know whether his call is from God, he should examine the marks of a divine vocation. He, says Saint Luke, who wishes to build a tower, first computes the necessary expenses in order to know if he has the means of completing the edifice. The marks of a divine vocation to the sacerdotal state. Let us now see what are the marks of a divine vocation. Nobility is not a mark of divine vocation. To know, says Saint Jerome, whether a person should become the guide of the people in what regards their eternal salvation, we must consider not nobility of blood, but sanctity of life. When God wishes to raise anyone to a dignity, he regulates his choice according to the sanctity of life and not according to the titles of nobility. Nor is the will of parents a mark of divine vocation. In inducing a child to take priesthood, They seek not his spiritual welfare, but their own interest and the advancement of the family. How many mothers, says St. John Chrysostom, or the author of The Imperfect Work, have eyes only for the bodies of their children and disdain their souls? To see them happy here below is all that they desire. As for the punishments that perhaps their children are to endure in the next life, they do not even think of them. Oh, how many priests shall we see condemned on the day of judgment for having taken holy orders to please their relatives? Neither nobility of birth nor the will of parents is a mark of vocation to the priesthood, nor is talent or fitness for the offices of a priest a sign of vocation. For along with talent, a holy life and a divine call are necessary. What then are the marks of a divine vocation to the ecclesiastical state? First, purity of intention, a good intention. It is necessary to enter the sanctuary by the door, but there is no other door than Jesus Christ. I am the door of the sheep. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. To enter then by the door is to become a priest, not to please relatives, nor to advance the family, nor for the sake of self-interest or self-esteem, but to serve God, to propagate his glory, and to save souls. If anyone, says a wise theologian, the learned continuator of Tournley, presents himself for holy orders without any vicious affection and with the sole desire to be employed in the service of God and in the salvation of his neighbor, he, we may believe, is called by God. Another author asserts that he who is impelled by ambition, interest, or a motive of his own glory is called not by God, but by the devil. But, adds St. Anselm, he who enters the priesthood through so unworthy motives shall receive not a blessing, but a malediction from God. The second mark is the talent and learning necessary for the fulfillment of the duties of a priest. Priests must be masters to teach the people the law of God. For the lips of the priest shall keep knowledge, and they shall seek the law at his mouth. Sidonius Apollinarius used to say, "Ignorant physicians are the cause of many deaths." An ignorant priest, particularly a confessor, who teaches false doctrines and gives bad counsels, will be the ruin of many souls, because in consequence of being a priest, his errors are easily believed. Hence, Ivan Carnotensius has written, "No one should be admitted to holy orders unless he has given sufficient proofs of good conduct and learning." A priest must not only have a competent knowledge of all the rubrics necessary for the celebration of Mass, but must be also acquainted with the principal things which regard the sacrament of penance. It is true, every priest is not obliged to hear confessions, unless there is a great necessity for his assistance in the district in which he lives. However, every priest is bound to be acquainted with what a priest must ordinarily know in order to be able to hear the confessions of dying persons. That is, he is bound to know when he has faculties to absolve, when and how he ought to give absolution to the sick, whether conditionally or absolutely, what obligation he ought to impose on them if they are under any censure. He should also know at least the general principles of moral theology. The third mark of ecclesiastical vocation is positive virtue. Hence, in the first place, the person who is to be ordained should be a man of innocent life and should not be contaminated by sins. The apostle requires that they who are to be ordained priests should be free from every crime. In ancient times, a person who had committed a single mortal sin could never be ordained, as we learn from the First Council of Nice. And St. Jerome says that it was not enough for a person to be free from sin at the time of his ordination, but that it was moreover necessary that he should not have fallen into mortal sin since the time of his baptism. It is true that this rigorous discipline has ceased in the church, but it has been always at least required, that he who had fallen into grievous sins should purify his conscience for a considerable time before his ordination. This we may infer from a letter to the Archbishop of Reims, in which Alexander III commanded that a deacon who had wounded another deacon, if he sincerely repented of his sin, might, after being absolved and after performing the penance enjoined, be permitted again to exercise his order, and that he, if he afterwards led a perfect life, he might be promoted to priesthood. He then who finds himself bound by a habit of any vice cannot take any holy order without incurring the guilt of mortal sin. I am horrified, says Saint Bernard, when I think whence thou comest, whither thou goest, and what a short penance thou hast put between thy sins and thy ordination. However, it is indispensable that thou do not undertake to purify the conscience of others before thou purifiest thy own. Of those daring sinners who, though full of bad habits, take priesthood, an ancient author, Gildas, says, "It is not to the priesthood that they should be admitted, but to the pillory." They then, says St. Isidore, who are still subject to the habit of any sin, should not be promoted to holy orders. But he who intends to ascend the altar must not only be free from sin, but must have also begun to walk in the path of perfection, and have acquired a habit of virtue. In our moral theology, we have shown in a distinct dissertation, and this is the common opinion, that if a person in the habit of any vice wish to be ordained, it is not enough for him to have the dispositions necessary for the sacrament of penance, but that he must also have the dispositions required for receiving the sacrament of holy orders. Otherwise, he is unfit for both. And should he receive absolution with the intention of taking orders without the necessary dispositions, he and the confessor who absolves him will be guilty of a grievous sin. For it is not enough for those who wish to take holy orders to have got out of the state of sin. They must also, according to the words of Alexander III, cited in the preceding paragraph, have the true positive virtue necessary for the ecclesiastical state. From the words of the pontiff, we learn that a person who has done penance may exercise an order already received, but he who has only done penance cannot take a higher order. The angelic doctor teaches the same doctrine. Sanctity is required for the reception of holy orders, and we must place the sublime burden of the priesthood only upon walls already dried by sanctity, that is, freed from the malignant humor of sin. This is conformable to what St. Denis wrote long before. Let no one be so bold as to propose himself to others as their guide in the things of God, if he has not first, with all his power, transformed himself into God to the point of perfect resemblance to him. For this St. Thomas adduces two reasons. The first is that he, as he who takes orders, is raised above seculars in dignity, so he should be superior to them in sanctity. The second reason is that by his ordination as a priest is appointed to exercise the most sublime ministry on the altar, for which greater sanctity is required than for the religious state. Hence the apostle forbade Timothy to ordain neophytes. That is, according to St. Thomas, neophytes in perfection as well as neophytes in age. Hence the Council of Trent, in reference to the words of Scripture, and a spotless life in old age, prescribes to the bishops to admit to ordination only those who show themselves worthy by a conduct full of wise maturity. And of this positive virtue, it is necessary, according to St. Thomas, to have not a doubtful, but a certain knowledge. This, according to St. Gregory, is particularly necessary with regard to the virtue of chastity. With regard to chastity, the Holy Pontiff required a proof of many years. From what has been said, it follows that he who takes holy orders without the marks of a vocation cannot be excused from the guilt of grievous sin. This is the doctrine of many theologians, of Hebert, of Natalis Alexander, and of the continuator of Tornley. And before them, St. Augustine taught the same. Speaking of the chastisement inflicted on Kor, Dathan, and Abiram, who without being called, exempted, or tempted to exercise the sacerdotal functions, the holy doctor said, God struck them that they might serve as an example, and thus to warn off him who would dare to assume a sacred charge. Indeed, this is the chastisement reserved for those who would thrust themselves into the office of bishop, priest, or deacon. And the reason is, first, because he who thrusts himself into the sanctuary without a divine call cannot be excused from grievous presumption. Secondly, because he will be deprived of the congruous and abundant helps, as Habert writes, he will be absolutely unable to comply with the obligations of his state, but will fulfill them only with very great difficulty. He will be like a dislocated member, which can be used only with difficulty and which causes deformity. Hence, Bishop Abeley writes, he who of himself, without inquiring whether he has a vocation or not, thrusts himself into the priesthood, will no doubt expose himself to the great danger of losing his soul, for he commits against the Holy Spirit that sin for which, as the Gospel says, there is hardly or very rarely any pardon. The Lord has declared that his wrath is provoked against those who wish to rule in his church without being called by him. On this passage, St. Gregory says, it is by themselves and not by the will of the Supreme Head that they reign. Divine vocation is entirely wanting to them, and they have followed only the ardor of vile cupidity, not certainly to accept, but to usurp this sublime dignity. How many intrigues, adulations, entreaties, and other means do certain persons employ in order to procure ordination, not in obedience to the call of God, but through earthly motives. But woe to such men, says the Lord by the prophet Isaiah, woe to you, apostate children, that you would take counsel and not of me. On the day of judgment they shall claim a reward, but Jesus Christ shall cast them off. Many will say to me in that day, have we not prophesied in thy name by preaching and teaching, and cast out devils in thy name by absolving penitent sinners, and done many miracles in thy name by correcting the wicked, by settling disputes, by converting sinners? And then will I profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. Priests who have not been called are indeed workmen and ministers of God, because they have received the sacerdotal character. But they are ministers of iniquity and rapine because they have of their own will and without vocation intruded themselves into the sheepfold. They have not, as St. Bernard says, received the keys, but have taken them by force. They toil, but God will not accept. He will, on the contrary, punish their works and labors because they have not entered the sanctuary by the straight path. The labor of fools shall afflict them that know not how to go to the city. The church, says St. Leo, receives only those whom the Lord chooses, and by his election makes fit to be his ministers. But on the other hand, the church rejects those whom, as St. Peter Damian has written, God has not called, for instead of promoting her welfare, they commit havoc among her members, and instead of edifying, they contaminate and destroy her children. Whom he, the Lord, shall choose, they shall approach to him. God will gladly admit into his presence all whom he has called to the priesthood, and will cast off the priest whom he has not chosen. Saint Ephrem regards as lost the man who is so daring as to take the order of priesthood without a vocation. And Peter de Blois has written, what ruin does not prepare for himself the bold man who of the sacrifice makes a sacrilege and of life an instrument of death? Please fast forward and go to tape number 11.